Okay, make sure you're in fellowship here, providing the interpretation of verse 17 here in terms of the turn that Dan as a judge takes into falling into a satanic agenda in regards to his position and execution of power. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path, that bites the horse's heels, that is, so that his rider falls backwards. And I am providing for us here connections that gives us the best candidate of the serpent judge in view as being none other than the false prophet, in correlation with the Antichrist during the period of the tribulation, fulfilling or fitting this prophecy. And we see language that is associated between the two, being a horned reptiles, snake, serpent, being used in regards to Antichrist, both referred to as being a beast, while they are distinct in their persons and positions of which they hold. They are united in agenda and purpose in regards to establishing satanic rule in a global effect upon planet Earth. So I recognize that Dan is noted for pagan idolatry as reputation. But to leave it holding only at that level of understanding in terms of this particular prophecy falls short of resolving the interaction between the serpent judge and the horse and rider that is in view. And I'm dealing here, as we're dealing here in point 53, we've identified the horse and rider in a single person as fitting the description given to Jesus Christ appearing at the second advent at the end of the tribulational period, riding a white horse. And his agenda is a path of righteousness designed to establish peace on this planet and victory over the enemies of God and the enemies of believers that otherwise have sought to dominate the entire political, as we'll see, judicial scene with respect to mankind. And we've been looking at verses here in Revelation where we derive much of our information. As I noted, point H here, page 28 of our notes, subpoint 53. Antichrist is a Gentile. He's from the sea. That's Revelation 13:1. The false prophet is a Jew from the land. So if he's a Jew from the land, he's from one of the tribes. You have to give me that. He's one of the tribes. And is, in my study, Dan fits the very description that one would attribute to what this false prophet pictures in the book of Revelation. And so, truly the prophecy to Dan enlightens us even more in depth of what I believe we went through even in Revelation, of focusing in on the false prophet and the magnitude of impact he has in regards to the whole Antichrist agenda in correlation with the Antichrist in and of himself. Obviously, generally, it's just Antichrist takes center stage. He's the marquee star of the movie and the whole works. But the false prophet is right there with him. the whole time. And he has a very large role to play on behalf of Antichrist in seeking to establish Antichrist in his rule, as he will step in with the revived Roman Empire, the European Union, to take control in that regards, and then of his interaction in regards to Israel in and of itself, of placing his image and convincing Israel that he is Messiah. Now, how does all that come about? He's a Gentile. What ambassadorship would he have to give him that type of influence otherwise, apart from simply a promise that, I'll protect you from your enemies, which obviously has bearing. But I believe there's more to it than that. So, if you've not heard the teaching of Revelation, then some of this may be foreign to you or new to you. But as it is, during the 7 years of the tribulational period, known as Daniel's 70th week, 7 years exactly, it is initiated at the point of the rapture. At that point in time, the Antichrist appears on the scene. The Antichrist is an unbeliever taken out from Sheol, Hades, hell, and resurrected in human form in this regards. And he will establish himself. He is a great orator. He'll show that he's died. He's come back to life. He's given, under God's permissive will, other great powers to try to evidence and validate his message that he gives to mankind. And he orchestrates the revived Roman Empire, and he will go in, and his arch enemy is Israel, basically, in regards to Jesus Christ coming in time to establish his reign over Israel. And he will, as we know through the prophecy of Daniel's 70th week, will establish a pact with Israel for 7 years. That pact is never fulfilled. So, just pick up point J here. The Antichrist makes a pact or a contract, a covenant, with Israel midway in the 7 year tribulation, as prophesied in Daniel's 70th week. Daniel 9:27. Now, the prophecy of Daniel's 70th week encompasses two distinct time periods that in total equates to 490 years. Each week is a 7 year period for 70 weeks. It's 490 years. The first aspect of that 70 week period is broken down to sum up in a period of 69 years. That period of 69 years brings us up to the first advent, the triumphal entry of Jesus Christ into Jerusalem. Verses 24 through 26 or 25 brings us up to that. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city. They're under a Babylonian dispersion under the prophecy here, which is for 70 years. Daniel's part of that dispersion, being taken into Babylon, as the book of Daniel records all the things that occurred, or many of the things that occurred in his life in that position. To finish the transgression, to finish God's judgment upon them for their national reversionism, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity. That is going to be the primary focus and in regards to Israel, and that has to come in two parts. And that comes and made a reality through the two advents. First, the spiritual deliverance to atone for iniquity, etc. Then the experiential deliverance, which will follow at the second advent. So, to bring in everlasting righteousness, that's the ultimate goal, that's the agenda. That's the horse, if you will, in our prophecy. To fill up vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy place, so you are to know and discern that from the issue of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. That's 69 weeks. That's 483 years. Dated from when Artaxerxes decreed to rebuild Jerusalem, recorded for us in Nehemiah. And it puts us, that was 444 B.C., March 5th. So we can date for that to March 33 A.D. as being fulfilled in 69 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress during that period. Then after the 62 weeks, the 7 weeks has already passed, so we're in the 69th week. The Messiah will be cut off. Indeed, he was. He was crucified. And further discipline, dispersion of Israel is coming down the pike that lasts for some 2,000 years, bringing in the church age dispensation. And that nothing, and the people, the prince who is to come, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now we're advancing into the final 7 year period in the language. And the prince to come emphasizes the Antichrist. And he's the one who's going to destroy the city and the sanctuary. That's his agenda. And its end will come with a flood. Even to the end there will be a war. Desolations are determined. And he, the prince who is to come, is not the Messiah. It's the man who's going to claim he's Messiah. That's Antichrist, the counterfeit Christ. He will make a firm covenant with the many for literally a week for 7 years. The 1 week is a mistranslation. Again, attempt to interpret. And then you would translate it, and in the middle of the week. Now the week has a definite article with it. That's the 7 year period. The final 7 years addressed here in the 7 year period, otherwise numbered up only to 69 previously. He will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abomination will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. So the scenario as it fits into the puzzle is the tribulation is divided into half, basically, in its representation in the Bible. 3.5 years, 3.5 years. Divided also in months. 42 months, 42 months. Another way to categorize it in time. And for the first 3.5 years, when the rapture occurs, Israel is going to establish, if not beforehand, at least prefabricated to a certain degree, a tribulational temple. Israel is going to re-engage back in animal sacrifice. They're going to reassume and embrace their heritage under the law in that regards. And there will be a tribulational temple built. And Revelation tells us all of this. We went through all this. And for the first 42 months, that temple is going to operate according to basically biblical guidelines. Halfway into the tribulational period, 3.5 years into it, Antichrist is going to gain access and authority to establish his image in this tribulational temple. And he will transgress it. He will make it completely and totally unclean in this capacity. How is he able to do that? Well, obviously, he convinced the government of Israel that he's their Messiah. That's how he's able to do that. And at that point in time, by embracing him as Messiah, he gives them their security promise in regards to protection militarily, etc. And for the negative Israel that remains still on this planet at that point in time, they will embrace him as their coming Messiah. The messianic expectation is in fever pitch over in Israel. It has been for quite a while. And midway into the trip, 3.5 years into it, this 7-year covenant is made with Israel by the Antichrist, assuming they accept him as their Messiah in that vein. So the question is, how is he able to convince Israel that he is their Messiah? Enter in the false prophet. Okay, the false prophet will arbitrate the negotiations between Israel and the Antichrist continuing for both parties, that Alexander, our best candidate for the Antichrist, Alexander the Great, is the Messiah. False prophet acts as the Antichrist ambassador to Israel because he's Jewish. He's someone that Israel would listen to. He's a prophet. He is given same types of evidential power through miracles, just like the Antichrist is in this regard. The Antichrist, Revelation 13, 12, he exercises all the authority of the first beast. That's the Antichrist in his presence. And he makes the earth and those who dwell in to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. And my question on leaving the last class is, how does he make him do this? And he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men. So great deception is coming upon the planet. And in this situation, you will not be able to look at physical evidence as proof positive one way or the other in regards to who's speaking the truth. There's only one way that you're going to be able to decipher and discern in regards to the matters at hand, and that is through the truth of Bible doctrine. The written scriptures and what they have proclaimed otherwise prophetically in terms of this situation. As Thessalonians says, the great lie, men will be deceived. And even so in the elect will fall into some of this during the tribulational period. The elect being those who become believers after the fact, falling for it. So he deceives those who dwell on the earth, verse 14, because of the signs which was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. See his interaction, his role of mediatorship between the Antichrist and Israel. He's the one that's instrumental. He's the power player to get the world to make this image. So he is heavily, heavily involved in regards to the Antichrist agenda in that regards. And there was given to him, verse 15, to give breath to the image of the beast. That the image of the beast might even speak and cause as many who do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. in verse 16 and 17, and he causes all the small and the great, the rich and the poor, and the free men and slaves to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. Again, how does he cause this to happen? What power does he wield to bring this about? And he provides that no one should be able to buy, verse 17, or to sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. And that number, as we know, is 666 in verse 18. So the false prophet's role in the Antichrist agenda is to represent both parties. Antichrist as the false Messiah, or as the Messiah, and Israel as he is a Jew himself. And he is able to validate supposedly his message through the miracles which he gives in this regard. And the government of Israel falls for this. It almost makes you not trust any government, doesn't it? Now, obviously, we have to. But anyway, to a certain degree. So 11, so the role that I see him playing in this, he will effectually, he will effectually act as a judge adjudicating the satanic pact supposedly providing Israel with their deliverance from their enemies. He will act in a legal way to bring about this covenant with the Antichrist by Israel. As we've read here, continuing on here, and it will be at this time that the image of the Antichrist will be set up in the tribulational temple, demonstrating his role in this unholy contract. That the Antichrist is who he's representing. So in, the false prophet is the, quote, cause, end quote, of genocide, as we read in Revelation 13, verse 15c, universally, according to him, legal status. He can only cause people to be killed if he has judicial power and legal power to enforce the law. He's a judge. He is a judge operating on behalf of the satanic agenda, the false prophet is. He will declare, this is the law. And anyone who breaks that law will be executed by capital punishment. If you do not take the mark of the beast. And otherwise, any of you out there in the world that think that you can get away with it, understand, we want people to tell on you if you're not following the laws as they are so otherwise determined. And he will use the principle of fascism, of bringing industry into a role with the government, which is already in place. Come on. To police for them. That's what you're not able to buy or sell if you don't have the mark. Who's policing them? Does Antichrist have a trillion army people to go out and stand at all these stores and places to do business in the world to see? No. The business owners do. This really, really opens the eyes in regards to the evil that's going on right in front of us now, today, in history, in our country. It's amazing what book you can be in and how it can be so apropos in regards to the time in which you live. And here, Genesis was written how many thousands of years ago? And you would think the Old Testament has nothing to do with today's prophetic revelations. Well, when it comes to Dan, it sure does. And as well as Judah. We've already seen that. So, he fits the title of judge, based on his very role as an arbitrator, contending for Israel as their protector, providing their protection through this pact, this covenant with his God, Antichrist Alexander. And he will lay down the laws, and he will see that the laws are executed through the judicial fields. He will be the premier Supreme Court, the Supreme Court commander, if you will, of the world. So, he functions as a, quote, judge, end quote, through the implementation and execution of the laws, mandates associated with the image of the beast. Put icing on the cake, so to speak. Q, this strongly suggests that the tribe of, the tribe of Dan is conspicuously absent in the list of tribes from which comes the 144,000 believing witnesses from Israel. And we brought that out. I brought that out for us when we did Revelation. 144,000 male, Jewish male virgins will be evangelized at the onset of the tribulational period, and they will be implemented in helping evangelize the world, along with the angels, along with Moses and Elijah and their part in all this. And there is 144,000 of them, 12,000 from each tribe. And no, the 144,000 isn't a Jehovah Witness. See what? People fall for this stuff. Why? Because they don't read their Bible. At least not to any degree of seriousness. And they are given special protection. No one can touch them and harm them during this period of time in history. They have a seal placed on by God, a protective seal. And then you have the list of the tribes recorded for us in verses 4 through 8. Verse 1, after this I saw four angels, that's Revelation 7:1, at the four corners of the earth. Well, earth is a flat, square planet. Four corners. Yeah, right, okay. There's four directions. Holding back the four winds of the earth so that no wind should blow on the earth or on the sea or on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, verse 2, having the seal of the living God. He cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the earth. See, God is in control of the weather. Angels will operate on God's behalf. They have obviously certain powers over the environment. This brings this out. Saying, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. Verse 3. So before environmental catastrophe starts to happen during the tribulational period, these time will begin for these men to be evangelized. That's the idea, in essence, being presented there. And then he heard, verse 4 and following, and I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. For the tribe of Judah, 12,000. Reuben, next, 12,000. Gad, 12,000. Asher, 12,000. Naphtali, verse 6, 12,000. Manasseh, 12,000. Simeon, verse 7. Levi, Issachar, verse 7. And then 8, Zebulun and Joseph. Where's Dan? Where's Dan? Dan's busy supporting the Antichrist. As a tribe, they historically are dispositioned, if you will, to reflect negative volition in a pagan way, in an idolatrous way. And obviously all of Israel has done it to a certain degree, but they stand out. Their representation is lacking in regards to that which is on the side of God during the tribulational period. So Q, this strongly suggests that the tribe of Dan during this time reflects the people adverse to conversion. Later on, believers come out. Well, that's obviously possible. But again, looking at the peoples corporately. So that fits the continued unbelieving motif. Makes me wonder how many Danites might be in positions of political power in Israel today that we're unaware of. As they continue to run the business of a nation. So through deductive reasoning and the prophecy bestowed upon Dan by Jacob, it is more than plausible that the false prophet is a Danite. Obviously, it's open for any further discussion, as I brought out earlier. If you can find a better candidate, or anything that destroys the pillars of my interpretation, my word studies, etc., I'm all ears to it. It would be interesting if somehow the tribe of Dan started making the news in some form or fashion in near history. So you can put that in the back of your mind. It's the only thing that makes sense to me in this prophecy. S, this representation of the tribe of Dan places its reputation in the darkest of circles in their heritage. A serpent and a horned snake biting at the heels of the horse and his rider so that he might fall backwards. It's an attempt to, which the whole period of tribulation is under Antichrist, false prophet, to change the course of history from God's design, divine design. Let's see. They can't do anything to Jesus. Satan knows that. So what's the avenue that they're going to take? It's through a political agenda. It's through a judicial agenda. Come on this planet and start changing the rules. Start changing the laws. See? To fit this global monarchy that Satan seeks to employ to get the world to worship him. That'll make the back of your hair on your head stand up. I mean, really, when you think just what's going on in front of us right now. Anyway, food for thought, if nothing else. And this definitely would fit the bill of describing them as 17, verse 17, or whatever verse we're 17 here of the oracle paints Dan as. 10 on the other end of the coin, yet they will remain as inheritors during the millennial period, recognizing the grace towards all other Danites that were believers. They become part of the inheritance. It doesn't mean the entire tribe of Dan, that all Danites are unbelievers. It doesn't go to that extreme. This is just a noted reputation of Dan producing a judge that engages in this type of evil, and which they, as a people, have a propensity to push that kind of stuff, as we saw in Amos, Ezekiel 48, verse 1. So out of the list, they're not listed in the 12,000, the 144,000, but they still remain rights of inheritance of real estate under the Abrahamic covenant. So 54, now recognizing the importance of this prophecy to Dan in terms of the last days, now gives substance to verse 18, for your deliverance I wait, O Lord. Lamed Yeshua, Kawa Yahweh. Attempted explanations of this verse leave you lacking, generally speaking, for commentaries. What's Jacob? Why did he say this in spite of all this? Well, now we know. And we'll put it together for you here. 55, the Hebrew noun Yeshua, translated salvation, is only used here in Genesis and has the primary meaning of deliverance. 56, proper noun Yahweh, transliteration, Lord, looks to the second member of the Godhead that will execute and ensure deliverance. 57, now the PL, perfect tense of the Hebrew verb kawa, translated I wait. And Jacob is in view here. This is reflection. This is a final reflection that Jacob has in terms of this oracle. So the PL, perfect tense of the Hebrew verb kawa, denotes completed action. Perfect denotes completed action. Imperfect, incomplete action in the Hebrew. And functions as a prophetic aorist of certainty, as it would be in the Greek. That is, Jacob is fully convinced that deliverance will come by means of Messiah. 58 is reflection upon or serves as a hopeful optimism. I believe a complete conviction that deliverance will be there by Jacob himself in light of the prophecy. In light of this prophecy. You can imagine he's prophesying this in regards to Dan. He's going, oh. This is news to him too. Well, I got one of my sons that out of his lineage, this evil's going to come out of this, you know. So 59, it involves doctrinal reflection by Jacob in two parts here. A, in light of the period of the dark history of Dan, first, the horse's rider will prevail. The horse's rider will prevail. So how would Jacob know this? One, Jacob gets this, grace after his perception, via further reflection on the blessing to Judah that symbolized the line of Judah defeating his enemies, sustaining his rightful place of sovereignty. The scepter will not pass from the line of Judah until he comes and he attains his position on the throne. Two, he knows that while evil may proceed in historical events, righteousness will overcome shortly after, nullifying the hostile attacks on the plan of God. The evil of being this judge lasts for 7 years. And then that's it. God will overrule it in that regard. So three, Messiah as a righteous judge, as he's so referred to in antithesis to this satanic judge of the false prophet, will vindicate the plan of God on behalf of Israel. Genesis 18:25. Abraham speaking to God, in reference to God as a judge. Far be it from you, God, to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? Under his protected by his attribute of righteousness. Psalm 7:11. God is a righteous judge and a God who has indignation every day. Wakes up righteously PO'd at the world for their rebellion against Him. 9:8, Psalm 9:8. Righteous indignation, reflection of exercising His wrath and in judgment, etc. That language of accommodation. And He will judge the world in righteousness as Yahweh the Lord. He will execute judgment for the peoples with equity, with complete fairness. And 96:13, as we went over these principles recently in reviewing the doctrine of the millennium. Before the Lord, before Yahweh, for He is coming, for He is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness, in the sphere of righteousness, and the peoples in His faithfulness, His immutability. He won't change the law on you. So that's the first part of it, that the horse's rider in the oracle will prevail over the attack by the false prophet otherwise. And He knows this because of the oracle He just gave to Judah. So B, secondly, His reflection draws spontaneous encouragement for Jacob in light of his impending death. After He finishes up with his final sons here in Benjamin, he basically lays back down in bed and God checks him out. So his final Bible class, he is drawing encouragement. So one, he recognizes the importance of prophecy in relationship to time, paralleling Judah's blessing, recognizes this is set for the last days, the ultimate fulfillment of the Danite prophecy. Two, it is a period of history that will bring about the advent of Christ to establish His earthly kingdom in fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. Three, this means resurrection and possession for His person under the covenant blessings. He draws encouragement from all of this. Four, His course is all but over. And all He has to do now is, quote, go to sleep, as death is so described in 1 Corinthians 15:51. And await for the fulfillment of this prophecy and God's response. So 60, death is referred to as sleep. It's not the end of your conscious being. But in terms of the reality of the things in the world, you'll be like you're asleep. You're disconnected from it. And all this gibberish that you see and hear that, well, I'm doing this because my mother, my father, my kids, they're all looking down on me. And they're so... People in heaven don't give a damn about what's going down here on earth right now, apart from God's plan being fulfilled. Come on, give me a break. It's nothing more than Roman Catholicism being perpetuated in celebration of the dead. People can't untie their emotions in regards to those things in life that they didn't want to use as a distraction for not embracing Bible doctrine on top of it all. Jacob finishes the blessing to Dan with great anticipation of awaiting glory and deliverance in spite of any evil Satan and men might do contrary to the plan of God. So I'll leave you with that one for the day. Father, again, thank You for the truth of Your Word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, continue to lighten us to these things. In Jesus' name, amen.